today I'm here with Jeffrey Tucker, who is in the process of launching a startup. He's been associated with the Mises Institute and runs Laissez-Faire Books and is in the illustrious state of Alabama. So, Jeffrey, thanks for joining us.
It's really fun to be here. I admire your site a lot. I like to listen to your interviews, so it's really fun to be, you know, subject to one of them.
Well, thank you for joining us. We're flattered to have you here. So, Jeffrey, can you tell us a little bit about who you are and where you come from?
Yeah. Originally from Southwest Texas, my family's been since about 1832, and I studied music a good part of my childhood and that sort of thing, and through high school, and then entered college and fell in love with economics. So kind of another form of music. It's a discipline that seeks to understand where wealth comes from, why society exists the way it does, and whether civilizations rise and fall, whether they're prosperous or not. And I just fell in love with economics as a science. And the more I looked into it, the more it seemed very clear to me that human liberty is the key to making the social order work. So I find that I've spent the rest of my adult life after school in exploring this topic and finding ways to get the word out there about a topic that I think is underrepresented generally in academia and in media, and it's namely the liberal tradition, which I find very beautiful and exciting. The subject of human liberty, well, basically covers everything, right? So there's no limits to. I never limit myself in what I write about. So I've written about everything from intellectual property laws to the glory of silly putty to the secret teaching behind Rebecca Black's videos, you name it. I consider the whole of the social order sort of fair game for my observations and commentary. And I've been, I think, fairly successful in this realm. So
you have. And so what brought you to Alabama?
I came here initially to work for the Mises Institute, where I spent a good many years building the website, which was an exciting thing. I remember the first time I kind of discovered the power of the web. I thought, well, I can take this physical thing called a book or an essay on this piece of paper I have, scan it, put it on this little digital thing, and it becomes universally acceptable, and it becomes malleable, and it becomes practically immortal. That is a dramatic transformation from something being bound up and trapped in the physical world. And I just fell in love with the idea that I could do this. Instead of a book being read by one person, it could be read by 7 billion people, or potentially trillions of people. It can be passed around, it can be downloaded and changed. This is the way to spread ideas. It was very clear to me from 1996, 1997, something like that, that we had a magic tool here. And so I threw myself into technology and building that world, and was responsible for putting thousands and thousands of texts online, along with lots of commentary. I built one of the earliest online academies and a specialized wiki page and online communities and all these sorts of things. I've just been intrigued. Always been intrigued by the prospect of sort of escaping the constraints of the physical world. And that's what the digital world has allowed us to do. I'm not the only one who saw this. The internet has changed our lives and has changed history completely. And I just fell in love with the idea and just embedded myself in that. And since I left the Mises Institute, I kind of refounded Laissez-Faire Books on a kind of a subscription model where you subscribe and can download unlimited numbers of books, and that works as a kind of a commercial venture. Now it's doing very, very well. So I'm adding to that a startup of my own called Liberty.me, which is a kind of complete social and publishing solution for this sort of liberty-minded space, which is growing internationally, and we really need our own little digital civilization. So I'm throwing everything I know at this. I'm astonished at what's become available for our use just in the last 2 years. Everything is just ramping up, and the possibility of creating a kind of a geographically non-contiguous global community of specialized interest is just so exciting to me. So that's what I'm doing every day now, just building and building. I'm glad to be back in it.
Yeah, no, it's getting better and better. So I have an unfortunate thing to tell you in that when I was growing up, I knew that I was I didn't know what a libertarian was, and I don't think that was well known back then. But I saw Michael J. Fox on what was the TV show, the soap opera that he was on for a long time.
Yep, I know what you're referring to. I don't remember the name of it.
Something Family or something. I saw him on that show, and I was like, "Yep, I want to be like him," because everyone else was kind of lazy and doing whatever, and he was well dressed and he was busy making money, and I thought that was excellent. And so then I went to university, and I was convinced to become a Democrat, and so I became a Democrat for 20 years or so, and then finally earlier this year I realized that I'm actually a Libertarian. And I'm a little bit offended that I've gone through this cycle, because I really would have been a libertarian right at the start had I known more about it. I'm curious as to what you think of that and what was your process in becoming a libertarian.
Well, I would be interested in how it is that you came and became a Democrat. I mean, there's usually little issues that drive people into certain ideological corners. Most of them have something to do with the longing for human liberty. I mean, this is the reason people become hardcore leftists is because, for example, they believe that there's some sort of wicked, you know, war machine that's you know, needs to be unplugged, or that there's a corporate cartelist system that's sort of rigging the social order in its favor. Or people become rightist because they're convinced the government is too big, or it's taking too much of our money, that's doing belligerent and nasty things to people. I think they're both right, you know. I think both sides are right. I mean, people are driven to these ideological corners because they have a sense that there's perceived injustice. And the reason I became a libertarian anarchist is because I think that this worldview addresses all the injustices all around us and provides a really good understanding for the right way out. My own intellectual trajectory began probably... I guess in high school I read some Ayn Rand, and I really continue to this day to be a big advocate of her. I mean, there's many, many things I don't agree with her on, but wow, she really had a way of sort of summing up the drama of capitalism in a fabulous way, and personalizing the human liberty project in a way that very few others have managed to do. So I saw.
I think Ayn Rand has saved the world economy.
Yeah, well, I mean, I wouldn't disagree. I think, you know, she's a very special figure, I think, in the history of literature. I love the way she personalized the project of liberty. You know, her characters are never victims of the state. They always sort of stand up and say, look, I have human rights, I am a creator, and I'm not going to let anything stop me. That's a beautiful attitude. And I think libertarians could actually learn a lot, even now, from that, rather than constantly going to the government and saying, please recognize my rights, please start acknowledging that I'm a free person. The heroes in the Randian novels just take the responsibility for their own liberties and rights upon themselves and make their own decisions regardless of what.
I actually went to her grave about 2 or 3 months ago. Have you ever been there?
No, I never have.
There, it was really interesting. It took a little while to find it. And then her grave is there beside Frank Connor's grave.
Yeah.
And on hers, people were leaving quarters on top of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's very interesting. I think in some ways Rand continues to be the great fuel behind the liberty-minded impulse. And I say that because there's a time in people's lives when they first encounter Rand, when they read something like Atlas Shrugged or Fountainhead or one of her smaller novels or whatever, they put down the book and they have a sense. They close the book and they go, damn it, I'm going to be different. You know, I'm not going to be a victim of anybody, and I'm not going to be put upon. I'm not going to be pushed around by any would-be despot. I am going to live a free and independent and happy life. And that's an amazing thing to happen to a person. I mean, that's a real revelation. It tends to stick with you, you know, forever.
I wasn't able to make money in business very effectively until I read Atlas Shrugged. And then when I did, making money became really easy. It was profound, the change. It was so quick.
Well, and so many of modern entrepreneurs have looked to her. I mean, yeah, I think Atlas Shrugged has had this huge influence on Silicon Valley entrepreneurs. Look, to be an entrepreneur, you know, you really have to kind of be dissatisfied with the status quo. You have to look out there and go, the world's not quite right, and I can change it. Yeah, and that's a crazy thing to believe in some ways. It's an implausible notion that your choices and your actions and your innovations alone can make a dent in the universe. You know, we're all taught that that's not true.
I was at Freedom Fest and I met an English guy there who had some really interesting conversations with. And see, in the US, you get this idea that you can do things, and in Australia that we don't. And he had the same thing in England growing up, where the consensus, what you just feel is that all entrepreneurship is everything is already done, and so there's no new business to be made, and so that's it. And you may as well go and get a job at a company because that's what your option is, because there's nothing new to be created.
Yeah. This whole sense in the U.S., I'm pretty certain, developed or became deeply entrenched after World War II. Before then, it wasn't there. Certainly, it wasn't there in the 1920s. The New Deal began to sort of cartelize the economy and define what approved work, you know, consists of. You know, gave the impression that you're only allowed to kind of pursue things that the masters in Washington give you permission to do. And then after World War II, I mean, World War II is this, you know, great central planning calamity, really, when everything was controlled and people were drafted and killed.
A war is like the greatest case for collectivism ever, isn't it?
And so then afterwards, you know, you had this sort of development of a corporate culture in America that was like a miniature version of government itself. So there's widespread impression, exactly as you said, you know, we had to develop this sort of W-2 wage system where everybody's, you know, you've got to get the right kind of training, then you move up the corporate, you get a job and move up the corporate ladder, you retire with a watch, and then the government takes care of you until you're dead. You know, that was the widespread impression of, because we didn't see a whole lot of innovation coming out of the private sector after World War II, and really for the next 25 years it was more or less stagnant. And then we began to see that consensus breaking down, and because Washington was unable to fulfill its promise, you know, as a manager of social welfare programs, as a war machine, you know, that whole thing that exploded, you know, with Vietnam. Then the monetary system collapsed in the 1970s. We ended up with, you know, terrible inflation, unemployment, and then political corruption, and, you know, has afflicted every administration since then. So that sort of consensus that, oh, we need the government to run society, really began to break down because there were too many anomalies with it. And then with the digital world, the opening of the information age, the whole project's become essentially unsustainable anymore. And we're seeing a systematic breakdown of that 20th century consensus in favor of something completely new and something, you know, really fantastic, and entrepreneurship is driving it.
Yeah. So tell me, I'm new to the libertarian movement, but you know, very, very much, it feels like I'm home finally. You've been a libertarian. How long have you been a libertarian?
Well, okay, so I mentioned my early experience with Rand, but it didn't really. It gave me a nice, you know, sense of motivation, but not a clear ideological coherence. Then in college, I guess probably it was about my junior year, I just sort of did some deep reading in Cold War history and dipped into some of the literature. And I think for a time, but a very brief time, a couple of years, I became something like the archetype of a right-wing conservative, you know. And then I discovered that paradigm really is inconsistent and doesn't explain the world around me in the way that I wanted to, and I just kind of lost all interest in politics as a method for managing the social order in any respect, you know, whether it's foreign policy or area of civil liberties or economics or anything. So by the time I was 22 or 23, something like that, I had just, you know, given up completely on that and embraced anarchism as a worldview. And that was, for me, a great liberation. I mean, once you kind of give up this idea that the state really can make any real contribution to our lives, there is a kind of an intellectual and mental freeing that takes place. You begin to see beautiful order, lovely things all around you that extend out of human action, human choice, rather than being imposed from the top. And to me, to be an anarchist is to have a really hopeful outlook on the prospects for humanity's capability of organizing itself without being imposed upon by central elites that are either appointed or elected. And that's an exciting thing to discover.
Which is what the internet gives us too. So a question then about the libertarian community. What percentage of libertarians would you say are lean libertarian left versus libertarian right?
Yeah, I puzzle about these terms. And I have many friends who consider themselves members of the libertarian left and people who consider themselves libertarian right. And I'm not sure how I would break it down. I have seen great advances being made on the libertarian left in the last few years. But that weren't there before, and I'm not entirely sure I understand where that's coming from. I think they have a lot of very valuable insights, though, by the way. I don't want to define myself as a libertarian left or a libertarian right. I think both sides have something important to say, and there's a lot of truth to both. I think it's just a different kind of temperament, maybe. I'm not sure. But I hang around a lot these days with an organization called the Students for Liberty, which I think is the world's largest libertarian organization at this point. And there are libertarian left and libertarian right. There's all kinds of perspectives. People who are focused on foreign policy, others who are focused on issues of like feminism, and other people that are just maniacally attached to the issues of economics or technology. So it's a very diverse community, and I'm seeing less and less of the so-called factionalism that we used to see in the pre-internet days. I'm seeing more and more people get along in a beautiful way. It's not like the old communists, you know, where they would just break into endless numbers of factions. Nowadays, I see a lot more adding and multiplying rather than subtracting and dividing taking place within the libertarian world.
But there is this, there is a distinction. I mean, see, I'm libertarian. I would consider myself libertarian right. There does seem to be some sort of distinction there, and there is some sort of a split. I'm wondering, is there an 80-20 sort of split, even though that the groups are coming together, or what you think?
Yeah, 80-20 sounds, maybe it's more like 70-30, I'm not sure. But, you know, and it's not as if the libertarian left opposes private property, for example. It's just that they have their own kind of issues that they tend to focus on, like... One of the things the libertarian left doesn't like is the corporate employment structure, for example. They think it's mostly artificial, you know. And they would tend to be more sympathetic, for example, to labor over capital if there's a dispute between the two. You know, they're probably more interested in issues of institutionalized racism and sexism and things like that. I mean, so I'd say there's an ideological sort of timbre to what they believe, but I'm not sure that there are serious substantive disagreements between the libertarian left and libertarian right.
Okay.
I think it's really a matter of styling and messaging more than anything else. And I say this I'm not just speculating, because one of my best friends is Charles Johnson, who's probably the most left of the left of the libertarian left. And we meet every week in a little group we call the Anarchist Meetup. and argue it out, right? Because I tend to be very pro-corporate. I love McDonald's. I think Walmart is heroic. You know, I celebrate corporate capitalism and rich people. You know, so I have all these impulses, right? And he tends to think of Walmart as just a kind of a privileged industrial cartel, and you know, McDonald's benefiting from massive, you know, subsidies, food subsidies, and just an extension of a sort of a patent-protected corporate racket. And you know, we argue all the time, but both of us grant that there's truth to what each of us is saying. You see what I mean? Right. It's a complicated world. I mean, both can be true. It's just that we just have different ways of addressing the topics, you know.
I like yours better. Although I never really thought of Walmart as heroic. That's a pretty funny thing to say, but I'll take that over other views.
Well, listen, I get dreamy when I go to Walmart. And it's hard for me to shop because I'm in such awe.
Walmart. You got to get those $1.99 specials. I take your point. Let's move on. So tell me about the Mises Institute. How big is it? I mean, that's what you moved to Alabama for. Can you explain that a little bit about what's been going on there?
The Mises Institute began in 1982, you know, long before the internet, and it was trying to address a kind of a dearth of information that was out there about this great economist, you know, who lived from 1881, I guess it was, to 1973, and taught, you know, in Austria and then in New York, and in Geneva and then New York, and left her a great body of literature. So I fell in love with the Mises Institute because it was dedicated to sort of advancing science and liberty and the tradition of Mises. So, you know, we were all about publishing, in the scholarly space and in the popular space in that tradition. I was good friends with Murray Rothbard, who was kind of our academic advisor until he died in 1995. And I met him in 1985, and he and I hung out a lot together, and he had a huge influence over me. In fact, he was certainly the reason I finally sort of bailed from the Hobbesian worldview and just embraced anarchism outright. So I have a great appreciation for him as a thinker, a writer, and as an individual. And so it was a real privilege for me to work there. I finally felt like my job had sort of was done there, and I wanted to take on a new project in the commercial space. I had worked in commerce when I was in high school and college, many different jobs, you know, in clothing stores and restaurants, and I just love that sort of roiling around that you get in the commercial world, that direct connection between the consumer and the producer that's so clarifying. And I feel like, well, you know, I don't have too many years on this earth, and I think I'll just take a risk and see what it's like and what's going on in those days. So I'm grateful for my time at the Mises Institute, and also I think it was a good decision for me to leave the nonprofit world and see what it's like in the world of commerce.
How many people work there?
Right now, I'm not entirely sure. I mean, I had a pretty big staff when I was there. It was both local and online. I had many, many contractors that I was working with internationally. So maybe at its height, there might have been 40 workers that were full-time or part-time, something like that. And so we did a lot of work for that few people.
And it's important what you guys are doing. And so maybe we can talk a little bit about economics. Now, this is a topic I haven't had time to get into yet, but I'm just going to be starting with Hayek and some of the other stuff. It seems to me that there's almost like a left versus right dispute in economics at some level, where the right says, which is what I would perceive to be the libertarian view, which is let capitalism run its course, try not to interfere with it, and right. it will go up and down, and it will be bumpy every so often, but it'll be fine, just sort of leave it alone. And we have the left, or I don't know how to pronounce it, Keynesian economics, which is essentially saying, no, we need the workers to go first and make sure that the workers are okay, and then that'll stimulate capitalism. Is that accurate, or can you maybe explain that?
It's okay. I mean, you know, I think the dispute in economics really comes down to, you know, very simple, and I say within economics, because there's plenty of people who don't understand anything about economics at all, and that, you know, can't even comment about these things at all. So within the realm of economics, I'd say that the main dispute comes down to those who believe that the price system is sort of self-stabilizing, and those who think that it needs to be prodded this way and that in order to achieve something like, you know, an equilibrium or a perfect competition. And this plays itself out in many, many ways. You know, the response to the business cycle, for example, you know, in 2008, when the world seemed to be falling apart, basically you had the Austrians saying, well, that's what you get when you use the central bank to stimulate an artificial boom. everything kind of gets distorted and out of control, and it's going to fix itself. And the way to address it is to let the liquidation happen and get on the firm braces for prosperity going forward, even if that means there's some investment banking houses that are holding a lot of worthless paper have to go under. That's just the way it's got to be. Any attempt to fix it is going to cause more damage. The other point of view, generally the Keynesian point of view, is that, you know, the system fell apart not because of an artificial boom, just because it's inherently unstable. So this is proof that we need government involved in ramping up aggregate demand, kicking the economy forward by creating trillions in new dollars, subsidizing certain kinds of businesses that are under pressure, and basically hammering the economy into some sort of shape in which we can experience prosperity again. So that's the outlook. And I mean, it's funny for me to have to state it in that seemingly fair way, because I think it's an absurd position, actually. So I don't believe it. And I don't think it worked. I mean, they promised that unemployment would be back to normal levels years ago, and it still isn't. So, and a lot of, there's still, the banking system's really unstable and essentially broken. There's plenty of things wrong with the U.S. economy. Our growth rates are absolutely pathetic. We've tried the Keynesian way, and it just hasn't worked. And it's not the first time. I mean, Keynesianism has never worked. I mean, they tried it in the 70s. They thought they could, manufacture this perfect trade-off between inflation and unemployment. And guess what? They gave us both, And people will sometimes look back to the New Deal and say, well, the Keynesian economics worked in the New Deal. I don't know in what sense anybody can say that, because the Depression, after all, we never really left it before we finally, found ourselves plunged into this ghastly war. The Keynesian style of central planning began in earnest almost immediately under the Hoover administration, and it didn't fix anything. It prolonged the Depression all the way to till we entered the war.
If there was one book to read that would explain the difference between Keynesian and Austrian economics, what would you say that would be?
Yeah, well, there's just so many. It depends on how much you want to take on. If you want to get really serious about economics, there is one book that will change your life, and it's Mises' Human Action. That is the great work. It's about 950 pages. I would recommend for new readers to start at about page 200 and skip all the sections on philosophy and epistemology and go back and read those. That's a big, big undertaking, and maybe too much for anyone. On the other side is probably a book like Mark Skousen's Economics on Trial, which is a good kind of overview of all the existing schools of thought. They kind of give you a good look at them.
Okay. No, I want to look into it. I don't want to read 100 books, but I'll read a couple. That's very helpful. So after then, you left Mises, you founded Laissez-Faire Books?
Yeah, so Laissez-Faire Books had been around since the 1970s. And it was a classic case of a business that just didn't make the leap into the digital age. It was enormously successful all throughout the 70s and the 1980s, and for the first half of the 90s, really. It was the main way that people were able to get sort of radical literature within the libertarian world. And they distributed through the mails, and it was a great success. And they made a great success of it from a commercial point of view. And then after Amazon came along, they just couldn't keep up. It just wasn't possible, and the business kept kind of being passed from hand to hand. And finally, landed over to Agora Financial in Baltimore. And they had it for about a year, and still couldn't quite make a go of it. So they hired me to try to make a success. So I was very honored to take that position, because there was a long tradition there with Laissez-Faire Books. I mean, this is a highly regarded institution, and for me to suddenly become the head of it was quite something. But then I had a problem. I had to figure out a way to make money.
Right.
Amazon. So my idea was that we would start to distribute, publish ebooks and distribute them on a subscription basis. So you pay, $10 a month, and you get unlimited downloads of everything we publish. That was before. There are a number of services that exist now. Here we are 2 years later. There are a number of ebook subscription services out there. But I'm pretty sure we were the first. And I'm rather proud of that, actually, because we actually did start making money. I think we entered into a profitability stage about 8 months after we opened up the business model. So I count that as a real professional success for me. And I tell you, there's something else that I don't know that I've ever spoken about this or ever been given credit for it, but one of the things that I don't believe in intellectual property. I think it's basically a state imposition, an attempt by government and private enterprise to kind of collaborate to create little miniature industrial cartels, you know, through legislation. And when I was at Mises, I first started experimenting with the idea of publishing not with copyright, but into the commons. So there are no restrictions on copying or use. And so when I went to work for Laissez-Faire, I told the management team there, I said, you know, I'm going to have a serious problem if we're going to use the old-fashioned copyright. I don't feel good about it. I don't think it's a good business model, actually. And they said, well, we don't know anything about that, but we'll take your word for it and do what you want. So every book I published, I've published at Laissez-Faire, I've published into Creative Commons Attribution License. And, you know, has that led to piracy? You know, maybe, I don't know, but it hasn't mattered in the slightest bit, actually. The point is that in the digital realm, what you're selling are not really goods. You're selling services, you know.
Right.
And, you know, we say, oh, you know, buy this book, buy this album. But you're not really buying books. You're not really buying albums. You're buying an incremental unit of download service, actually, is what you're buying. Everything else is just a metaphor. So I knew that not having copyright was not going to make a difference as to whether we succeeded or not. And it's also really great for the authors, because I could tell our authors, okay, you write this book for us, but we're not going to take your book from you. You can continue to retain rights yourself and publish, you know, the whole thing with another publisher. If you don't like us, you can just get another publisher. You can publish excerpts on your blog. We're not going to steal your ideas, you know. And that makes for a good relationship with authors. Publishing in the commons is a good way to get along with people. Using government is a good way to create conflict. But using market means, and I consider publishing without copyright to be part of the free market means of publishing. So I always had good relationships with all of our authors, and it certainly didn't hurt our business model, and it probably helped.
Kind of makes you want to have been alive during times like the Wild West, when things were just getting started and they didn't have all this government getting in the way of everything.
Yeah, that's right. And that's sort of what the internet is, and that's why most startup entrepreneurs are, as you know, exploring this great new real estate called the cloud. You know, it's a space for freedom. It allows us to exercise our creativity and make the world new again. The physical world has been mostly ruined by large Leviathan states, you know, taxing it and regulating it to pieces. I mean, there's no product that we say that isn't, you know, highly, highly regulated by the central government and taxed, and they've made a real mess of the world. But in the internet, we're seeing real creativity take place in amazing ways, right? I mean, it's not just the delivery of cool new products and services. And we're seeing innovations that are potentially earth-shattering, and I would list Bitcoin as an example of that. I mean, we're actually seeing innovation in the monetary sphere as well. You know, it's remarkable.
Yeah, so talk a little bit about Bitcoin. You've been talking about Bitcoin for a long time. I started looking at it. I went to Bitcoin 2013 in San Jose, which was less than 6 months ago. I went just out of for curiosity's sake, and now I've put all my spare cash into Bitcoin, unfortunately buying in just after the run-up happened. But I'm friends with Eric Voorhees and Yufu Zhou and a bunch of the guys who are really making Bitcoin happen. And it took me a long time to get my head around it, but now that I'm there, it's really clear where we're going with it. Yeah. It seems like you saw it quite a long time ago. I'm curious as to your thoughts, and have you got a lot of Bitcoin yourself and what you're doing?
Well, so what happens, so the reason it's hard to wrap your mind around it is because we've had 100 years of monetary nationalization, during which time we saw virtually no innovation whatsoever. I mean, we money was nationalized, with the invention of the Federal Reserve, and development stopped. The rest of the economy continued to improve, but money just got worse and worse and worse. Then credit cards were invented in the 1950s, and they've kind of been hacked and hacked and hacked to the point that they more or less kind of work in the digital world, based on third-party relationships and trust. But the existing system of government monies, come out of credit cards, has led to vast exclusion of a third of humanity from involvement in the matrix of exchange. I mean, it's actually a cruel and wicked system. Now, I had heard about Bitcoin probably for the first time in 2010. My first reaction to it was the same as many people's. It struck me as another weird, geeky online service, some sort of strange file type, that I was going to take too much effort to try to figure out. So I didn't, and I've read a lot of articles about it, but I still didn't quite grasp it until I only fully threw myself into it earlier this year. And that was at a conference in New Hampshire. And these Bitcoiners surrounded me and said, listen, buddy, what's your problem? You need to get into this thing. And just have me download an app on my smartphone and gave me some Bitcoin. That was back when it was $15 or something. I don't know what it was. And I felt it arrive, on my phone for the first time. And, it gives a little buzz. I thought, whoa, that's real. And then I began to sell some bow ties at the event to these Bitcoiners who wanted some bow ties. And I began to sell them, and I began to kind of collect some Bitcoin. I thought, this is kind of cool. So I came back home and started to really read about it. And the problem in this space is that, Bitcoin is such a big topic. It's hard to find the thing that connects with you. Because if you're not interested in cryptography or open source networks or distributed networks or these kind of complex, code topics, it can kind of confuse you slightly.
That's actually a good point, because I had no real entry point into it either, other than just seeing that it was something new in tech that I needed to keep an eye on. That was my only entry point, which isn't a very good entry point.
It's not. And so you feel a sense of intimidation about it. This is why there's so much ignorant talk online about this, by the way. All the time you hear people putting it down, talking about it, and then you read their works and you realize, oh, okay, this guy doesn't actually understand anything about Bitcoin.
Right.
This is really common. It's a little bit embarrassing, actually. People should just stop talking about it if they don't understand it. But what did it for me, there was an article, I think, in Wired magazine that kind of went through the history of the attempted digital currencies before Satoshi Nakamoto's Bitcoin came out in early 2009. And it said that they all had the same problem. They're unable to solve the problem of double spending. And I thought, what is that? Well, double spending means that you use the same piece of property twice. You're in effect creating new money. And this is what the digital world specializes in copying. But copying is not what you want to have happen in the realm of money. That's the worst thing. That's like the Federal Reserve. That's what they do. They copy. And it depreciates the money. But what Satoshi did is he was the first one to really solve the double spending problem. He created a really beautiful public ledger that accounted for every unit of Bitcoin and its title, and put together a distributed network of verifiers that could verify each transaction and resolve the blockchain, every 10 minutes and make sure that everything's lined up, every piece of property is lined up with an owner, and everything's accounted for all the time. And through this method, he was able to control the pace at which Bitcoins are created or mined and put a cap on them. And that's what did it for me. When I read that, I thought, okay, this is real. This is serious. He's solved the key problem.
Right.
And this is what I think, for any person well-read in monetary theory, this is the thing that vexes you slightly when you hear about Bitcoin. You think, oh, some darn thing created by a computer? Well, anybody can do that. That's not worth anything. Until you discover that there's a very strict system of property rights associated with Bitcoin, unlike national monetary systems, where the property rights are very vague and ambiguous, and nobody knows how many dollars there are, who owns what we have a right to, what we don't have a right to. Nobody knows these things. With Bitcoin, everything's extremely clear and methodically worked out and really, really open. So there doesn't have to be an audit of the Bitcoin movement. You know, there's no masters behind the scene, you know, secretly regulating it. It's all there for the public to see. And so what he did is he recreated almost a medieval style sound money system within a digital space. And then and thinking about that, and that all, that realization hit me, you know, in the course of about 48 hours. And I was just, it blew my mind. I couldn't believe it. And it's consistent with what we've seen in the digital age. You know, we've seen mail reinvented, become email, the old phones that used to be strapped to our walls we now carry around in our pockets. You know, the digital age is reinventing everything. Right. So I thought, well, heck, you know, why not money too? So then I went on my first spending spree, you know, and then it was all over. I realized as a pure payment system, this thing is just leagues, light years ahead of our current systems. And then I realized that's of course the value of Bitcoin is its payment system. That's where it initially got its value from, because you can transfer instantly real money property to anywhere in the world with virtually no transactions costs whatsoever.
Right. I did another one the other day, and it was amazing. I was going to have to send money to a friend in Colombia, and he was a little bit nervous about Bitcoin, but I was like, no, give it a try. And you know, the fact that I was able to, it's easier than going into PayPal and to go in and send the money to him, and then it's faster than PayPal, I guess. And well, maybe PayPal is a little bit quicker because the blockchain takes a little bit of time to update. But the fact that there's no fees. And there's no intermediaries.
But PayPal, it clears within the PayPal system, but that doesn't actually mean that the money is transferred. That still takes time. It can take days and days, actually. So Bitcoin, you've got the real deal, not a money substitute, not a third party verifying something like that. It's the real deal transferring from one person to another. And mostly, and I don't know if you've noticed, that the transactions time is going down and down and down. I mean, these days when I send money, it arrives in a matter of seconds, you know, and that's just amazing. I mean, try to do that through your banking system. Clearing these days, you know, is 3 and 4 business days to get money from one person to another, just sending it through your bank. It's and then you still have to use all these third party providers and, again, trust relationships. You have to have bank accounts, and there's just a gigantic apparatus. A real fraud risk is always there. None of that is true for Bitcoin. I mean, Bitcoin is, I mean, the great thing is it's shown us something we never thought we'd see before. You know, it's revealed to us what a genuine market-based money system could be like. It's also really fun to me because, you know, coming out of an academic world, monetary reform isn't supposed to happen this way. You're supposed to have professors write big papers, they get published in all the big journals, and then they go over to Federal Reserve officials who are intrigued by them. You know, then some mucky muck at the top, you know, has a committee meeting, they implement it, and you know, then maybe there's a global monetary conference where all the big shots, you know, rework the system. It's all top down and has been for 100 years. Satoshi is just hilarious. You know, you've just got one geek or a team or nobody really knows for sure, just sort of cobbling together. Sometime in 2008, a protocol that was released free online in early 2009, and with the message, hey, here's our new money. If you like it, use it. See what happens. So it's been entirely a sort of bottom-up revolution.
I believe what's going to happen with it, because I think it is going to win, although I think there's going to be regulation at some point. But I believe that buying in now is going to be a little bit like with the Russian oligarchs, that when they were taking in after the communist empire collapsed. I think it's going to be a similar sort of dynamic. I really do think these can go to $1 million a coin.
Well, they can, but already we're seeing, you know, this whole generation of nerds and geeks that first got involved in Bitcoin in 2009, 2010 are now, you know, become moguls themselves. I mean,
right.
I just last week I was involved in a wonderful donation from a single donor to the Foundation for Economic Education, who gave 1,000 bitcoins.
Right. You know?
And that's
that was Roger Ver, who I'm interviewing tomorrow.
He's a great man. And, you know, what he did for FEE was amazing, because this is a 50-year, 60-year-old organization that really needed the support. And he's, you know, that one donation made a huge difference. And I love reading the Bitcoin's, you know, subreddit, where you every day there are people like, well, I paid off my college loans today with Bitcoin, you know. I bought my mom a house, you know, and so on. So, you know, you're seeing this kind of funny generation, these people that we used to laugh at and put down in high school as being gamers and dweebs and nerds and geeks, now have become a kind of a new aristocracy.
Yeah, well, wait until the rest of the public starts buying it and Tulip Mania really hits, because it will. And I'm looking forward to that. Anyway, let's move on. Tell me about bow ties.
Oh, yeah, you know, I guess I'm sort of rather known for them, and it's funny to me because I never really thought much about bow ties. I've been wearing them since I was about maybe 16 years old, and the main reason was that they sort of stay out of your way. You know, whereas you've got a long tie, it's kind of flopping here and there, and lands in your soup or, you know, whatever. It's something you always have to keep up with. And I love the fact that bow tie, you can just throw it on and forget about it, yeah. So I began to wear them, and I didn't really think anything of them. But you know, nowadays, since everything you do is sort of online, I mean, I can't go anywhere without having, you know, pictures, you know, appear on Facebook or whatever. It seems to have become something of a, you know, a personal symbol of some sort. So, I mean, it's pretty amusing. I had a funny thing happen to me. You probably have seen the pictures. I think, actually, you've got one for the show, but I was in Turkey, and we were in the, went out to sea, you know, in boats to just have a day of swimming and eating fish and things like that. And it was just about, you know, about 80 of us on four or five different boats. And I thought, well, we're out in the middle of nowhere. And a little pirate ship came up, you know, it was a fake pirate ship, and they were demanding, oh, jump in the water with your bow tie, jump in the water with your bow tie. And I thought, well, but they were very insistent. So I thought, well, okay. So I went down below, and I put on my swim trunks, and I left my collar on. I took my shirt off, but I left my collar on and just put the bow tie on and walked out. And then, you know, I thought, well, this is just for us. We're out in the middle of nowhere, and nobody will ever see this. It's not going to be embarrassing. And then the cameras started going, you know. And within minutes, the pictures were all over Facebook. So it was a little bit surprising to me. It was all very silly. And then I think that one of them ended up on the cover of a magazine in Hong Kong called Capitalism. So, yeah, they became a little bit famous. Yeah. And nowadays, I like to take extra bow ties with me and give them to people, and people seem to be really happy to get them. So, you know, it's funny. John T. Malloy has a book that came out, I think, in the 1960s, maybe 1970s, called Dress for Success. And he has this passing comment about bow ties. He says, you know, they're elegant, they're pretty. He said, but I don't recommend them for job interviews, because there's something about a bow tie that makes people kind of think maybe you're secretly a bomb thrower.
So that also helped draw you to them.
Yeah. So yeah. So as a symbol for the bourgeois anarchists, they seem to work very well.
And how many bow ties do you own?
Well, it goes up and down, because I'm forever giving them away or selling them and then buying more. But I try to keep it at about maybe 50, something like that. Yeah.
Cool. And so we haven't talked about your startup. So if you can, just tell us a little bit about that. I know it hasn't launched yet.
Yeah, we mentioned it earlier in the interview when I was talking about sort of this for me is the newest iteration of the thing I've always dreamed about. I've always thought that whatever is great about the physical world could be reproduced and improved in the digital world. And one of the things that's great in the libertarian world is hanging out with other libertarians. There's, you know, Liberty on the Rocks, Students for Liberty, these great conferences, Freedom Fest you mentioned earlier. Well, what if we could extend that 24/7, 365 days a year to an online piece of real estate that provides, you know, complete, you know, free chat and social networking plus publishing platform, and it's all focused on praxis, not so much on theorizing, but on ways to achieve liberty without having to ask for government to give it to you. Yeah, So I wrapped all that up in a package, sold it to some investors who said, you know, this sounds fantastic. There's nothing like it that it exists. Let's go for it. So that's what I'm doing right now. I've been building for 3 months. I got the best technicians I know, the best graphic designers I know, and we're doing something just completely outrageous. There's no platform that compares in just its sheer ambition and scale online. I'm hoping to create a happy, happy world of play and surprise and joy and creativity for people who are really interested in freedom right now in our times. So that's what it's about. I've got a Kickstarter that's going to, capitalize me a little bit so I can make it to February 15th for our release. And tomorrow I'm making the video for this Indiegogo, did I say Kickstarter, I meant Indiegogo campaign. And I guess there's no problem in my telling you what I'm going to do because I'm not sure when you're going to run the interview. But if all goes well, I'm going to be in a double-breasted wool suit with a high collar and bow tie on a high dive in the middle of a lake and take a plunge into the water in the middle of winter. So that should be very interesting. I've been, you know, spending some time at the gym and, you know, really getting ready for this. So it's going to be a wonderful stunt. And the idea is we need to just take the plunge into liberty. So that's the plan. So we'll see how it goes.
Very
this
cool.
This will be my last interview.
Let's hope not. Is there anything we haven't talked about that which you'd like to cover?
One of the things that I think... let me just say this as a way of closing. You mentioned that you feel yourself very much drawn to libertarian outlook in life, and I think that's brilliant. The big problem I see in our libertarian world is there's just too much despair. And the reason for that is that people begin to realize the government's this terrible thing. It's our enemy. It ruins everything it touches. And it's just kind of depressing. And if that's all you focus on, then you can lose interest. So I'm trying to redirect the attention of the liberty-minded community over to away, not away from the state, but toward the beauty of private enterprise and the beauty of human action to remake the world and, you know, instill a more of a hopeful outlook, encouraging libertarians to do startup businesses and find ways to make the world a better place using the liberties they have to create more for themselves. I think that's a better way to approach human liberty, and it prevents burnout and keeps people involved and excited. So that's, and I think this is a better path in politics, if I was going to just put it very frankly. I think it's a more productive use of our time. So
that's a good thought.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Jeffrey, thank you very much for doing the interview. This has been great.
Yeah, it's really been fun. Thank you so much for having me, and thank you again for putting together your wonderful website, which I just love and can hang around on absolutely all day. It's just great to talk to real human beings and how they're changing the world. So thank you for doing what you do.
Thanks again.